Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're joined now by Doug Johnson. He's Legislative Director of National Right to Life. We're going to speak briefly about yesterday's action on the Senate floor, where the Senate approved a ban on partial birth abortion. Doug, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you.
Tell us about what took place on the Senate floor yesterday.
Well, the Senate gave final approval to the bill to ban partial birth abortions. It's a bill that National Right to Life has been working to enact for some 8 years. Many listeners will recall that President Clinton vetoed the bill twice, and then for another couple of years it was blocked by the Democratic leadership in the Senate. But now we have pro-life leadership in the Senate. The House, of course, passed the bill by almost a two-thirds majority, and President Bush is eager to sign it.
Tell us about the bill itself. What precisely does it ban?
It bans the method of abortion in which the baby is mostly delivered alive before being killed. The bill very explicitly defines this, and in fact, because the five justices of the Supreme Court 3 years ago struck down a Nebraska law that banned partial birth abortions, and one of the justifications they gave is they were afraid, these five justices were afraid, that it might affect some other abortion methods in which the baby is dismembered piece by piece while still in the womb. So Congress now has been very explicit in saying a partial birth abortion as a matter of law is an abortion in which the baby is delivered feet first until everything past the navel is delivered outside the woman's body, or if it should ever be done head first, if the entire baby's head is outside the woman's body. And this is while the baby is still alive and is then killed. Now, in fact, it is done as a feet-first procedure, and they keep the baby's head just lodged just within the womb, just within the uterus, and the abortionist then punctures the base of the skull with a long surgical scissors, a 7-inch scissors, and removes the baby's brain with a suction machine. That's what a partial birth abortion is. This would ban it unless it was ever necessary to save a mother's life, which we don't think ever would be the case.
What about a challenge which seems inevitable? Will this bill see the light of day?
Well, certainly Planned Parenthood, the ACLU, and some other groups are poised to go into court as soon as the president signs the bill. Usually federal judges do block abortion bills from going into effect while legal issues are hashed out. So I would hope that wouldn't happen, but it's quite likely to happen somewhere for a judge to issue an injunction. And ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court is quite likely to review this. And, you know, we are aware that just 3 years ago, five justices said that the Constitution guarantees the right of an abortionist to do a partial birth abortion really whenever he sees fit. Certainly through the 5th and 6th month of pregnancy, which is when the great majority of these are done, and even later if he can cite some health reason to do it, and that includes emotional health. So that really covers, you know, any circumstance in which somebody would want to do one. Now, this bill is really inviting the Supreme Court to reexamine that extreme and inhumane decision. And we just hope by the time the case gets up to the Supreme Court, there'll be a shift of at least one vote away from that extreme position they took 3 years ago. It was a 5-4 decision, so just a one-vote shift in our direction could uphold this law. And that could occur, of course, through a justice changing his or her mind or recognizing that there are some differences between this bill and the one they considered 3 years ago. Or it could occur through a change in personnel on the court. That's always a possibility.
Is there any substance to the objection raised by the opponents to this ban on partial birth abortion that this is merely the first step or step one in overturning Roe v. Wade and that this seriously weakens Roe v. Wade?
Well, you know, funny thing is, people mean a lot of different things when they say Roe versus Wade. There's a lot of people who think Roe versus Wade is far more limited than the real Roe versus Wade, which is the one that the Supreme Court majority is enforcing. And there's no illustration of that that's more compelling than this issue of partial birth abortions. In the Gallup poll this year, 70% of the American people said that they favored a ban on partial birth abortion, whether it's done in the second trimester or the third trimester. 70%. Well, five Supreme Court justices said a ban of this procedure violates Roe versus Wade. So in the minds of those justices, this would be contrary to Roe versus Wade unless one of them decides that there's some important difference here or that they got it wrong the first time. A lot of people think that Roe versus Wade, that they're shocked to learn that Roe versus Wade allows something like this. Of course, we think that Roe versus Wade ultimately should be overturned. We think it's been an enormous tragedy. It's led to enormous assaults on innocent human life, and this question of partial birth abortion is just one little facet. There are many, many other facets of abortion practice in this country that do not have support from the majority of Americans, but there's still a real dearth of education. There's a lot of people who are still under a lot of misconceptions about what the state of the law is and what the state of abortion practice is. They don't realize why most abortions are done. They don't realize how they're done. And only slowly is some of this sinking in. We think the debate over partial birth abortion has really been enormously important in opening a lot of people's eyes to how extreme the current situation is, how the unborn child at this point really has virtually no legal protection in the abortion context at any point during prenatal development, and that this is the result not of democratic processes for the most part, but of the decree of a majority of the U.S. Supreme Court. I think they're way out of step with the majority of public opinion. There's certainly nothing in the real written Constitution on which their decisions are based, and so we hope that this will be the beginning of a movement back in the direction of sanity and respect for innocent human life.
What is the biggest myth being perpetrated about partial birth abortion by the pro-choice side?
Well, gee, there are so many, it would be hard to pick out just one. But, of course, one of their favorites is the claim that these are very rare procedures and that they're only done in really acute medical circumstances. And the major secular news media, for the most part, adopted that as unvarnished fact for the first couple of years of this debate back in 1995 and 1996. But that was a misinformation campaign that was cooked up by the pro-abortion lobby, the abortion industry. And it ultimately collapsed. Investigative journalists finally went out and actually interviewed abortionists, and they found a substantial number of them that do partial birth abortions on all comers. And even a spokesperson for the Trade Association of Abortion Clinics, the National Coalition of Abortion Providers, finally in 1997 just repudiated this whole, what he called a party line, and he said the vast majority of these are done on healthy fetuses of healthy mothers, and they are done thousands of times a year. That was the head of the National Coalition of Abortion Providers. And yet we still do see some of the pro-abortion groups trying to revive these old myths. Just a couple of weeks ago, the Planned Parenthood Federation of America put out a press release here in Washington where they claim that this bill would, and I quote, outlaw medical procedure used primarily in emergency abortions, end of quote. They know that's not true, and there is abundant evidence on the record that it is a lie. And anybody who wants to view that documentation can certainly visit our website at www.nrlc.org, nrlc.org. where we have a lot of documentation on this issue.
Senator Barbara Boxer, who has been in opposition to this bill from its very beginning, called yesterday's vote a very sad day for women in America. Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey, he said a woman's right to choose is in the greatest danger now that it has been since the Supreme Court issued Roe v. Wade. Your response to those comments?
Well, the great majority of American women, of course, favor a ban on partial birth abortions. So when Senator Lautenberg or Barbara Boxer, for that matter, purport to be speaking for women, they're clearly speaking for a minority of women. And on this issue of partial birth abortion, a rather small minority.
How significant is this first legislative victory in 30 years for pro-life Americans?
Well, I think it is significant because it is the first time that the Congress has passed a ban on any type of abortion since Roe versus Wade, or perhaps ever. And it's also significant in the broader sense that it's, even though this is several thousand abortions a year, so one might say, well, there's so many done by other methods that this doesn't address, and yet it has taken away the mask, you might say. The abortion industry, the pro-abortion advocacy groups have spent decades with putting up these rhetorical screens of euphemisms about women's rights, autonomy, the products of conception, blobs of tissue, and so forth. And even though this bill only addresses one method of abortion, it has opened the eyes of many Americans to the types of brutalities that are allowed under the law and that are entailed really in all abortions. I mean, it is true that this bill bans the particular method where the baby is mostly delivered alive and then killed, but there are a greater number of abortions done at these same stages of development in which the baby is dismembered and brought out piece by piece. Now, that's excruciatingly painful. That's brutal. But people have not heard as many details about that. So we think it is an educational process. We talk sometimes about the media filter, which is the way the specifics, the grisly specifics of abortion are often filtered out before they reach the broad public. But to some degree, the debate over partial birth abortion has penetrated that filter, and a lot of people's eyes are being opened.
Finally, Doug, do you have any idea when the president will sign this ban on partial birth abortion?
We do not know yet when that will occur. The formal papers haven't even been transmitted yet to the White House, and there has been no announcement. The president is actually out of the country right now. He has expressed in the past his eagerness for Congress to approve this bill, but we don't have any information on exactly when the signing will occur.
Doug Johnson is Legislative Director for National Right to Life. He joined us to talk about the Senate's approval of the ban on partial birth abortion yesterday. Doug, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you.
Doug Johnson, if you want to contact National Right to Life, you mentioned the website there, nrlc.org. I'm sorry, nrlc.org is their website. You can visit them, or you can call them, area code 202-626-8800, area code 202-626-8800. A few thoughts on that conversation with Doug. First of all, I think a point he has made several times there is important to repeat one more time. The partial birth abortion ban has been difficult for everyone to talk about, and it's been a long road to hoe, don't you think? But all this long conversation dealing with the gruesome details of this, perhaps the most gruesome of all the methods of abortion, all this conversation has left the American public with a distinct impression about what at least this kind of abortion really is. The fact that, did you notice in the headlines today, it was often being reported, Senate bans type of abortion. I only read one major headline that was in the Washington Post that actually said Senate bans, in quotes, partial birth abortion. As uncomfortable and unseemly as it may appear, and as awkward as it often is, as we carry out the public debate about abortion, one of the strongest tools that we have as pro-lifers is simply telling people what abortion is. People who may sit on the fence may be on the fence because they simply have not taken the time to learn, or more likely than not, they choose to ignore the gruesome details of abortion, be it partial birth abortion or any other kind. And although there are people who can still sit on the fence when they've been faced with the gruesome details, there will be people who, if they understand what exactly takes place, will, out of just sheer conscience, say, no, we can't do that. There's one benefit. We need to be careful not to declare victory too soon, because, of course, even with the president's signature, this bill may not see the light of day. Well, just have to try again. For the next few minutes of the program and into the second half of the last hour of Issues Etc., Rita Marker is our guest. She's an attorney and executive director for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide based in Steubenville, Ohio, author of the book Deadly Compassion. We're going to get an update on the euthanasia case of Terry Schiavo. Rita, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
What's the latest on the case of Terry?
Well, the latest on the case of Terry is that she is again receiving fluids, which, of course, was very important since she was denied fluids from last Wednesday at 2 p.m. until last night at a little after 8 p.m. Now, when I say she is receiving fluids, it doesn't mean that she's out of the woods yet, but it means she's certainly in much better shape than she was a week ago. The reason I say she's not out of the woods is because her husband is making a concerted effort to make sure that Terry is dead sooner rather than later. And he is going down all avenues possible in the courts. And he also, on top of that, has engaged in, I think, what I consider continuing cruelty. He has again banned any visitors to Terry so that her parents cannot see her, her brother cannot see her, her sister cannot see her. He has isolated Terry, and they cannot even find out for certain how she is doing. But we do know that she is receiving fluids.
What was her condition after 6 days of starvation and dehydration?
Amazingly, her condition was very good. It takes 5 to 21 days for someone to die of dehydration. And, in fact, deaths that occur when the feeding tube is pulled, the death is not from starvation, it is from dehydration. Whether a person is a healthy Olympic athlete or a 39-year-old brain-damaged woman, that person will inevitably die, without question, within 5 to 21 days. And so that was what would happen. Now, when I've talked with her attorney on, well, many times in the last few days, but night before last, it was amazing because at that time, there were absolutely no signs and symptoms of dehydration. By last night, she was looking rather gaunt and a bit less responsive, but still would not be said to be in really dire straits. Interestingly enough, her husband's attorney issued a statement today saying that it was wrong to rehydrate her, to continue to give her fluids because the dying process had already started and it would just cause suffering to give her fluids. Well, that, I guess, one word I can use for it is just plain dumb. This would be like saying if someone had been lost out in the desert in Arizona, or if they had been lost up in the mountains of Wyoming for 6 days and they didn't have any food or water, and someone found them, that you shouldn't give them any food or water because the dying process had started. Well, of course, that's ludicrous. And it is good, very good, that Terry is receiving fluids right now.
The attorney for Michael Schiavo has, at least last night, I had heard a soundbite from him threatening civil action against anyone who took part in the rehydration of Terry.
Well, that was sort of some grandstanding, and it was an attempt to threaten, but they were idle threats. In anticipation that this bill was going to pass, Deborah Bushnell, who's working with George Filos, the main attorney for Terry's husband, sent a fax to every physician in Pinellas County, that's the county where Terry is, and had said because Michael is the guardian and he has to approve all medical treatment, he, of course, was not approving that she receive fluids, and so that any doctor who reinserted the feeding tube or provided fluids would be sued for malpractice and battery. Doctors were a little, well, when I say a little, they were very afraid because they did not know at the time that the bill that had passed actually was very clear about the fact that they would not be liable to any civil action. And so when they found out that, it made a difference. But when she was first moved from the hospice to the hospital for reinsertion of the tube, the doctor refused at the time to put in the tube. But they did start her on IVs. Now, we have no way of knowing, her parents have no way of knowing, whether or not the feeding tube has actually gone back in. But the word is that she is receiving fluids, but we don't know exactly how yet.
What always seemed to be the real problem here, and we've discussed this with your colleague Wesley Smith on many occasions, is the identity of Terry's guardian, namely her husband, as you said, would like to see her dead sooner rather than later. Is there anything that can be done to challenge his legal guardianship over his wife?
Well, apparently there is something in the works on that. There is a very strong and credible Florida disability rights group that has filed some action to check into abuse and neglect, because a guardian is supposed to look out for the best interests of the ward. Now, Terry's husband was named her guardian. That isn't automatic because he was the husband, but soon after she collapsed and was unable to make her decisions, he petitioned for guardianship. Her parents didn't oppose it at the time because Michael was pledging that he was going to care for Terry for all of her life and that she had a normal life expectancy, and they thought he was a loving husband. Well, then he was named the guardian. And it wasn't until after the lawsuit and a $1.3 million settlement and the check was in the bank that all of a sudden Michael decided that his wife would not want to live anymore. And so by then, he was already the guardian. And he portrayed it as though the family was just trying to get the settlement money and all this sort of thing, when in fact they were very concerned because once that money was in the bank, Michael cut off any care, any rehabilitation, and in fact that money was supposed to be used for rehabilitation. Terry has not had her teeth cleaned for over a decade. She has not had a gynecological exam. He has denied just basic types of care, not just treatment, but basic types of care. The parents have said this must be investigated, and Judge Greer, who has been the judge throughout this, has just essentially dismissed it, has just ignored all of that. And so with this new group going in to check out whether there has been abuse and neglect, it's very possible, and with the fact that the governor has asked that a guardian ad litem be appointed who would have to look and see what Terry's condition is and whether she's been getting what she should get. It's very, very possible that indeed his guardianship could be challenged successfully.
As an attorney, would that be done by way of asserting that he has been essentially neglectful?
Yes, neglectful that he has not carried out his duties as a guardian, because the role of a guardian, the courts appoint guardians, and they are to act in the best interest of the ward, the person that they are the guardian for. And if they do not do so, then they are not carrying out their duties and certainly can be removed. One of the problems here is that with everything that he has done, Judge Greer has given his seal of approval on virtually everything, but we don't know if Judge Greer knows all that has gone on, nor do we know if anyone knows all that has gone on, because no one has been able to get to the bottom of it because Michael will not give access to a lot of the information. There's also the fact that what has been alleged, and it has not yet been investigated thoroughly, is that her initial reason for her collapse may not have been a potassium deficiency as was thought to be, but X-rays that were taken of her as soon as she went into the hospital and which had not been examined until just recently are consistent with someone where there had been a strangulation. They also found broken bones that may have indicated spousal abuse. Her coworkers did say when they were asked about it just relatively recently that, yes, she would come to work with bruises sometimes and that Michael had done it, that he was pinching her or whatever, but she was bruised. So the possibility, and of course there's no way of knowing, it has not been proven, so it would be just an allegation, that the possibility is that there may have been spousal abuse indicated in what actually caused her condition.
Rita, hold that thought. When we come back, I'd like to continue our conversation. Will you stay with us?
Can for a very short time, yes.
All right. Rita Marker is an attorney and executive director for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide based in Steubenville, Ohio. She's author of the book Deadly Compassion. We're getting an update on the euthanasia case in Florida of Terry Schiavo. When we come back, a few more questions. Who will decide the constitutionality of the Florida law that at least temporarily has stayed the execution of Terry? We'll find out when we come back.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
In an abnormal world, death is normal.
Answers with Ken Ham.
president of the Apologetics Ministry of Answers in Genesis. Well, Ken, shouldn't you really say that death is abnormal? Haven't you got this the wrong way around here?
Well, actually, I have it the right way around. I'll never forget the words of my late brother from a sermon he once delivered to his church. Robert said this, "Death and suffering are normal in an abnormal world." He then paused and said, "Let me say it again. Death and suffering are normal in an abnormal world." My brother wanted his congregation to understand that because of Adam's sin, we now live in an abnormal world. Because of sin, God judged Adam and all his descendants with death. The ground was cursed. God withdrew some of his sustaining power to give us a taste of life without him. Now there are diseases, disasters, and all sorts of terrible things happening across this now abnormal world. But God sent his Son to pay the penalty for our sin by dying on a cross. When you trust Christ, you can look forward to a normal world in the new earth that God will restore one day. There'll be no death, disease, or suffering.
One of the most asked questions we receive at the Answers Ministry is, why would a loving God allow death and suffering in this world? Ken Ham provides the answer from the book of Genesis and shares it in a free booklet available on our free website, AnswersRadio.com. Next time you're at your computer, log on to our attractive website, AnswersRadio.com.
Good afternoon, 5:31 at AM 850 KFUO. Currently sunny and 68 in St. Louis. Tonight, partly cloudy, low of about 53. And for tomorrow, mostly sunny and a high near 69. Sign up to be a day sponsor during Rally Day. That's Thursday, October 30th, 1 week from tomorrow, right here on AM 850 KFUO. Another look at St. Louis traffic. Northbound 270 between Olive and Page. Some slow traffic there. Then in the right lanes, exiting onto Highway 70. Westbound 40 between Kings Highway and Hanley, slow traffic there. Southbound 170 between the Club Tower and 40, slow traffic in the right lane. Westbound 40 at Route K, some slow traffic. Let's take a look at the bridges. Northbound 55 between Park Avenue and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic in the right lane. And eastbound 40 between Jefferson and the Poplar Street Bridge, some slow traffic. That's traffic and weather right here on AM 850 KFUO. I'm Craig Allen.
Underwriting on AM 850 KFUO provided by Reliable Heating and Cooling. Christian people who understand the value of bringing you God's Word on the radio. The folks at Reliable also know how important it is to have your furnace checked before winter. An inefficient or deteriorating heat exchanger costs you needless expense and could be dangerous. A preseason inspection from Reliable is convenient, affordable, and gives you peace of mind. Reliable Heating and Cooling, supporting the broadcast ministry of AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. In the last half hour, we continue our conversation with Rita Marker, getting an update on the euthanasia case of Terry Schiavo in Florida. In a little bit, we'll be joined by Ken Woodward, religion editor for Newsweek magazine, to talk about the beatification of Mother Teresa. Rita, a couple more questions before I let you go.
Sure.
The constitutionality of the Florida law that was passed through the House and the Senate in Florida in the last week will certainly be challenged. Who will decide its constitutionality?
The Florida Supreme Court will ultimately decide that. Now, I've heard some of the talking heads today saying, oh, well, it's going to be declared unconstitutional because the legislature tried to overturn a court decision. I think that is totally erroneous, because what happened was that the legislature clarified an area in Florida law that had not been addressed. The bill that was passed night before last said, in the case of someone who does not have an advance directive and has not given some clear and specific instructions related to food and fluids, in such a case, then if food and fluids, someone wants to remove them, and a family member disagrees, then it cannot be done. So if it does not affect in any way the advance directive law, living will law, durable power of attorney for health care, only those cases where there is not clear and convincing evidence as to what the person wanted. And it makes it very clear that even then, it will only be stopped if a family member, not some outside group, but a family member says, wait a minute, let's make sure this person continues to receive fluids and is not dehydrated to death. So this is not changing any existing law. It is not overturning any existing law. It is clarifying what the situation is related to people who have not made specific decisions.
One thing that I don't see addressed in the press very often, although Wesley Smith has brought it to our attention many times as we've been tracking this case, and that is the bad acts on the part of Michael Chavo, the husband of Terry.
That's
the
right.
Fact that he has, in essence, taken up residence with a woman he intends to marry once Terry's dead, and even fathered children. Tell us about
it. Well, this is clearly a case where it screams conflict of interest. Michael Chavo has not visited Terry much at all. I mean, has totally ignored her in recent years. He is living with another woman. They have one child and another one that is to be born relatively soon. And he stands as the husband of Terry Chavo to inherit any remaining money that is left in for her care. So you have two situations here where someone would say, wait a minute, is this really the appropriate decision maker? Many times we hear of him referred to as the loving husband who has stood by his wife and is only trying to carry out her wishes. But add those two things to the fact that he didn't remember those wishes until after the money was in the bank. In fact, before that, he was saying that he planned to care for Terry for the rest of her life and that she had a normal lifespan. So clearly, there is what I think any reasonable person would say a real conflict of interest here. Now, Terry's parents have said, look, we can understand if you want to get on with your life. We can understand if you want to divorce her. And, in fact, if there's any money left for her care, take that, too. Just let us care for our daughter. And yet he has not done so. In addition to that, then, as I mentioned to you, he has said nobody can visit Terry. He has not let her have the normal care that someone would receive. So there are just a number of things that make a person think this is a real problem, and this is certainly not someone that one would want caring for anyone.
Rita, where is the outrage from the usual advocates for women, the feminist groups in this case? Because this is a case of a husband, at least according to the facts as we have them, who is treating his wife in the worst possible way.
Well, I don't know where their outrage is, but I have to tell you, it can't be laid just at the feet of the women's groups. How many people who are listening now and who have become very upset about this have not really paid much attention to this issue, and yet Terry is not the first one. So I think rather than our trying to say this group should have done something, this group should have done something, this group should have done something, we should all instead say, look, we now realize how bad this is. And it should be recognized that this is happening every day across this country. The only reason we hear about Terry is because her parents love her enough to really try to protect her. People need to be aware of this, and they need to know that they need to protect themselves and their families. The best way to do that is to sign a durable power of attorney for health care, naming an agent to make decisions for them and urging everyone that they love to do so as well. But I want to caution, not just any durable power of attorney for health care. If people want to be protected, they can give us a call. We can send them information on this whole issue of food and fluids. We also have a document that is state-specific, one for Missouri, one for Kansas, one for wherever, so that people can do something about this. Because it doesn't do any good for us to sit here and say, ain't it awful, and gee, those people should have been involved. If we're going to do something worthwhile, instead of just being entertained by listening to a radio program, we can say, all right, this is terrible, and we are so thankful that Terry is now receiving food and fluids. Now what do we have to do to make certain that this doesn't happen to someone else? So would you mind if I gave our website and phone number so people can contact us?
I will do that right now. The website that Rita mentioned is for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. Write it down, folks. IAE.
No. No, that's not it anymore.
Okay, give us the right one.
It's internationaltaskforce.org.
Internationaltaskforce.org. The telephone number, area code 740-282-3810. Take her advice, folks. Rita Marker, thank you very much for your time, and thanks for being our guest.
You're very, very welcome. I was glad to do it.
Rita Marker is an attorney and executive director for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, based in Steubenville, Ohio. She's author of the book Deadly Compassion. Now, earlier today, I had the opportunity to interview Ken Woodward. He'll round off our conversation here on Issues, Etc. I talked to Ken about several issues in the Roman Catholic Church, including the beatification of Mother Teresa. And I asked Ken, What are the steps for sainthood in the Roman Catholic Church?
Well, very simply, when someone dies and has a reputation for holiness, they usually wait a number of years to see if that reputation stabilizes and ripens. In the case of Mother Teresa, she had this incredible reputation, and there were they had over 600 requests to give her a top priority at the Vatican, and in effect put her on the fast track, so that when the Pope wavied the usual 5-year wait, it was in recognition that her reputation was not about to go away. You know, if it was you or me, they'd have to wait. So when they start a process, they investigate the life to see if the reputation is deserved, which is to say they look at all the letters and they look at what's been written by and about the candidate. And more importantly, they hold tribunals in which people are invited to give testimony either for or against the candidate. In the case of Mother Teresa, and this is what interested me, since she was so universally applauded, I was interested to see if they did in fact seek out, as they must by canon law, people who didn't think she was a saint. And they did have, they invited 4 people and 3 of them showed up, none of them Catholic. When they examine the life, they look to see if the candidate has the virtues of faith, hope, and charity, prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance, and then humility. And in the case of a religious person like a nun, did they keep their vows of poverty and so forth? So they did all of that, and then when they bring this all together, a guy called a relator puts it all together and makes the argument for the candidate. It goes to 9 judges, and if 2/3 pass, then she's declared heroically virtuous and called venerable. Then they look for a miracle of intercession. People always get confused about this, Todd, because she could have walked on water to work every day and that wouldn't have counted. These are miracles of intercession that occur after her death. And this is taken to be a divine sign from God that all the human efforts to investigate the person's life have been validated. That's the way the miracle system works. They chose a particular miracle. What they did in her case is they didn't wait for her virtues to be approved. They did the miracle at the same time, which also saved time. So, and the Pope gave it top priority, which means the 30 cases are, on an average that they do a year, she was put to the head of the list. So that's why it took a record time, less than 7 years.
And now that she has been beatified, what needs to be done in order for the canonization to be complete?
Well, what's required is another miracle, usually healing miracle, of intercession from the time she's been beatified. So they've got to wait on one of those. I mean, sometimes they've waited centuries for one of those. In some cases, perhaps you don't realize, I wrote a book called Making Saints, how the Catholic Church determines who becomes a saint, who doesn't, and why. Published about 1990. So I spent several years on and off at the Vatican looking over the shoulders of the guys who actually do this work.
So what's the difference between beatification and canonization?
Well, there's a long history to this. It means that Catholics can venerate this person within a region or a country or within a religious order. So it's a restricted veneration. When a person is declared a saint of the Church, then that person is universally recognized. My own view, for what it's worth, is that perhaps they canonize too many people, and that they ought to wait until a person reputation does persist. Somebody like Dorothy Day is universally revered, although she hasn't been beatified yet. A lot of saints are just known locally, so I would reserve beatification, which is essentially sainthood, to those people who have a rather limited following, let us say.
So now, does Mother Teresa hold the record for the for the most rapid beatification?
She sure does. As far as the records go back, I think I think it's about 1588 when they established what is really the basis of the modern process. But the idea of recognizing some people as people of outstanding holiness goes all the way back. I argue in my book that the first sort of in quotes canonization takes place right in the Book of Acts, where the proto martyr Stephen, his story of his martyrdom is told, and it's exactly the story of Jesus all over again, the innocent man who is put to death and dies forgiving his friends. So it's really, for all the supposed mysteriousness and complications of it, it's really a storytelling process. This person's story gets told as, in some sense, the story of Jesus all over again. Or, to put it more precisely, how all of us who are called to extraordinary holiness might embody in our lives discipleship to Christ.
In the case of Mother Teresa, 67 volumes it took to tell her story. What intrigues me is you mentioned critics of Mother Teresa. What did the critics have to say?
Well, I mean, some people didn't think she was terribly prudent, and others felt that perhaps she wasn't always just. She could be abrupt with people. See, this is what I was looking at and why I did the story, because it seemed to me that she was so universally recognized as an exceptional person that they might have whisked it through without listening to the critics. And I think that the fact that they were willing to recognize that even saints, even Mother Teresa, can be imperfect, you know, it's not a question of perfection. It's a question of extraordinary virtue. A lot of the saints' stories, if you read them, you could admire them, but you wouldn't always want to imitate them, you know? Some of them could be irascible and so forth. And when we see flaws in them, then I think we can identify with them, even though they may be extraordinary in other kinds of ways. Yeah, she wouldn't let her nuns, for example, use washers and dryers. She wouldn't let them buy in bulk, you know, and therefore save money, because she said, look, I want you to live just like the poor that we are trying to help. The poor don't have money to buy in bulk. They don't own washers and dryers. So while it would have been more efficient and in that sense more prudent, the point of identifying with the poor took priority. That kind of things that they sift through.
Now, I'd like to turn our attention to the most recent, besides Mother Teresa, the most recent news out of the Vatican, and that is the installation of 30 new cardinals. Tell us about this.
Well, I mean, here's what I found really interesting about that. I mean, after all, popes from time to time name new cardinals, and when you've been a pope as long as this one has, 25 years, and the fact that you don't get to be a cardinal normally when you're a young man, it doesn't take too many years before most of the cardinals who exist are your own appointees, and that is the case with this pope and with the church at this time. So there was nothing unusual about that, except that he rushed it. They would have thought that he naturally would have done it next year. What I find interesting is that he, in effect, summoned all the cardinals to Rome, and not just the 30 who were men who were becoming new cardinals. And this gave them an opportunity to do something which normally they don't do until a pope dies, which is to sit around and get to know each other and talk about the qualities that they would want in a successor, and the kind of issues that the successor is going to face. So people who don't like this pope feared that he would try to manipulate this process. In fact, either because of his health or because of his own decision, he stayed away from him for the most part and let them have these discussions. And I think it's terribly, terribly important. 135 out of roughly 190-some cardinals will elect the next pope, And the other one's doing because they're over the age of 80. So they get to know each other and talk about these things. And it's about time.
We're talking with Ken Woodward, religion editor for Newsweek magazine. Ken, you mentioned the Pope's health. That is obviously a major topic of news, period.
Mm-hmm.
It seems as likely as not, at least to me, that this Pope could be incapacitated while still in office. That is, basically unable, due to Parkinson's and age, to carry out any of his duties. If that were to happen, what would the Vatican do about that?
Well, unfortunately, they don't have the kind of arrangement that some corporations have, that a CEO becomes incapacitated in that way. There's a committee that sort of removes him from office. They've never faced this, although they've faced situations where the Pope is not healthy, and when that happens, you know, who's running the shop is always the question. And that's a question that comes up right now. So they don't have any answers, and this Pope has said he's going to stay in office because he feels that this was God's will for the Church, that he be the Pope at this time. It's a very perplexing situation, and they don't have any procedures for dealing with a Pope who's mentally and as well as physically incapacitated.
We spoke yesterday to Uwe Simonetto, who's religion editor for United Press International. He has written recently about the prospect of the next Pope, prognosticating a bit there. He says that it's likely to be a European at very least, maybe even an Italian. And he was kind of cutting the list of likely candidates down due to age, having to do with the fact that he believes, he said the saying was, after a fat pope, there should be a skinny pope. People are hoping for a shorter pontificate with this pope's successor. What do you think?
Well, that's been my view all along. I was recently asked to respond to a speech given by Cardinal Rodriguez of Honduras. He's often mentioned as a possible candidate. He's only 60 years old. He's a very fetching, very bright, well-educated person coming from, you know, Latin America. But at 60, it seems, you have to ask the question, do they want another long reign? On the other hand, they're looking firsthand at a guy who is who an athlete all his life, has aged and diminished, before our very eyes, and they may be having second thoughts about, you know, getting an older person in there. What's an older person is a question, I suppose. This Pope was 58 when he was elected, and that's very young indeed. John the 23rd, I think, was like 78 or something like that. Was only served 4.5 years. But in terms of what he did and in terms of his outlook, you know, he was a very young man, often compared to John Kennedy.
Finally, Ken, this is just personal curiosity. There was a recent movie, Luther, that had national release. I think it's kind of ending its run now here. Mm-hmm. Have you seen the film? And if you have, what did you think of it?
No, I'm sorry to say I haven't. I hadn't caught up on the Luther stuff. I've gone through my Luther phases, which is to say reading books and thinking about him in relationship, especially to the other reformers and all of that. But no, I didn't see the movie. Was it good?
Yes, I thought it was very good. I thought it was very good. I encourage you to see it before they pull it out of the theaters.
Well, I'll have to catch up with that.
All right. Ken Woodward is religion editor for Newsweek magazine, and he is author of a recent story for Newsweek titled The Fast Track to Sainthood. Ken, thanks for being our guest on Issues Etc.
My pleasure.
You know, Ken had some things there to say about the beatification of Mother Teresa that I found interesting during our conversation. Now, it's one thing to talk about, you know, the historic steps toward canonization, someone being declared officially by the Roman Catholic Church a saint. And there's no doubt about it. The kind of virtuous life, at least as far as we can observe it with human eyes, the kind of virtuous life and life of self-sacrifice led by Mother Teresa is something to be admired and commended. Although I don't think there's anything in that life itself that would lead a Christian to say, well, she's deserved sainthood. And even Ken permitted this. He said, Mother Teresa, no one is perfect. If sainthood is a matter of our virtues in life, our good deeds and self-sacrifice, our obedience, then none of us can be called saints. None of us. So how is it then that Holy Scripture refers to all of us as saints, all who are in Christ as saints, without making any distinction between those who live these heroic lives of self-sacrifice and those of us who live ordinary lives? How is that? Well, we're being referred to as saints not on the basis of who we are or what we do in ourselves. The apostles are so bold to refer to us as the holy ones of God for one reason and one reason alone. And that's the reason that Mother Teresa is a saint and was a saint even before the Vatican got around to recognizing sainthood in their terms. All who believe in Jesus Christ, who depend not upon their own righteousness or deeds or works or obedience, but upon his righteousness, his works, his obedience. All who believe this way are saints, without distinction. The holy ones of God, declared holy because of the righteous deeds, the merits, the works, and the virtues of Jesus Christ. And like the cart follows the horse, the virtues and the obedience and the life of the Christian do follow, as a matter of course, growing and flowing from this faith that does not depend on works, only the works of Jesus Christ, that does not depend on personal virtue, only the virtue of Jesus Christ. He alone has perfectly obeyed God, and yet God in his mercy, for the sake of Jesus' sacrificial death on the cross for us, another act of perfect obedience and virtue, God in his mercy declares us, calls us holy as his own Son, Jesus Christ. All who believe this, Mother Teresa, anyone else, all who believe this are saints. God calls them saints. And even the smallest deeds, not the ones that are noted by others when we're dead, but even the smallest deeds done in faith toward God, this complete dependence upon what Jesus has done for you, are those good deeds that God calls good for Christ's sake alone. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.